The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
It is now my delight and honor to introduce our 2009 One Book, One Philadelphia author, Mr. Steve Lopez.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much for these 18 degrees. Very nice. It was 80 degrees when I left home. Thank you. I froze walking here across Logan's Circle. No, I do want to thank you. Although, there's something that's bothering me. I might as well get it off my chest right now. There's something that I do resent. It's about all of these wonderful things that have happened since I left town. The Phillies win the World Series. Yeah, yeah. The Eagles may go to the Super Bowl. And Vince Famone may go to prison. I left just a little bit too early. And coming back here is so great because it's like home. And I'm not saying that Vince is guilty. I haven't followed it that closely. But I do have on good authority that he called ahead to the prison to see if they have any auric vacuum cleaners. And tonight's event is actually a fundraiser for Auric Vacuum Cleaners. It's the Vince Fund. Have you read that in his place over here, was it on Spring Garden, he had 19 vacuum cleaners in his one house? What kind of a man needs that many vacuum cleaners? What the hell is Vince Fumo's problem? And why didn't he do more of this kind of stuff when I was here? It's an amazing city. I went today. I was doing an interview at 15th and Walnut. I'm walking out with my escort, and she bumps into somebody she knows. Hello, hello. Goodbye, goodbye. I said, who was that? Oh, he just got out of prison. He got caught up in the bug scandal at City Hall. It's my kind of city. I went right away to look at a condo because I'm thinking of moving back. You bump into it on the... That's how easy it is in this city. You bump into it on the street. You're walking down the street. There it is right in front of you. Just got back from prison. So you know, of course, that he'll be opening a business as a political consultant. Within, what would you say, 2 weeks, 3 weeks? Come on. I mean, that's what you do, right? They're not going to invite me back if I keep talking like this, are they? I'm supposed to be talking about this book. Did everybody get a seat that I cornered upstairs and tried to get down here? And there's people upstairs who are stuck in that lobby. I'm sorry you got stuck up in the lobby. Can they see me or just hear me? Because let's hear from them. Can they roar from upstairs? Oh, jeez. Look, I'm sorry you got the cheap seats up there, but I want you to know, you know, come on, I'm coming back to Philadelphia. Why would you get here so late that you can't get into the den? What were you expecting, that I'd been forgotten, all of you people upstairs? And by the way, those of you who are upstairs, okay, so maybe that's second class, but you are all sitting in the room and right on the spot, in fact, where I was married. All right, that's right. Right at the base of those stairs. Are you looking at the stairs? Let us know. That's where I was married. It was, I don't know, 12, 13, 14 years ago. How many years? I don't know. Okay, let me tell you a little story, all right? I do love being in Philadelphia because I so loved the city while I was here. It just, I felt an instant connection when I moved here with my family. One of my sons is in the audience tonight, and he was raised here, and this is home for him. And maybe we're a bit nomadic, but Philadelphia has a place, special place in our hearts. And, you know, if the living is so easy in California, why have I turned white since I left, you might be asking yourselves. I mean, look at me. I had a full head of dark hair when I was here. Maybe I was preserved by this 18-degree weather you've got. I don't know. Okay, so this doesn't come apart. I can't wander around up here? No? Stuck behind this podium? Okay. Let me tell you a story about why I'm here. I'm here because 4 years ago, and it's almost exactly 4 years ago, I was doing what I did here in Philadelphia for all of those years. I was wandering around, casting nets, trying to come up with the catch of the day. Now in Philadelphia, you just go somewhere around City Hall. It's not too hard to catch something. But I was in downtown Los Angeles one day, and, oh, look at that. I get to wander around like... Does that work? Yeah. Because I really want to be when I, when the newspaper industry goes completely down in flames. I'm taking over for Maury Povich. I can't stand still right there. But one reason I can't stand still is because I have prepared no speech tonight. I have no idea what the hell I'm going to tell you. And if I'm stuck there, I'm going to feel really terrified. So I'm going to wander around and I'll see somebody I might recognize. It'll jog my memory. And I can tell a story. I don't know. So I'm in downtown Philadelphia, and thank you very much. This is a good crowd. That was just testing. Just testing. And did they get it upstairs? So I'm in downtown Los Angeles. And, yes, there is a downtown Los Angeles. We do have occasional pedestrians. I know you're shocked to hear that. Actually, the downtown, it's a great downtown. Thousands of people on the sidewalks. Here's what I was doing. I was going to check to see if, because it was drizzling, the escalators had stopped working. Los Angeles is a city where you would think they would do everything in their power to encourage people to use public transit. But every time it drizzles or rains, the escalators at the subway stops shut down. All you need is a forecast of rain in L.A. The escalators stop working. And I started looking at the repair contracts and found that somebody who was making those hundreds of thousands of dollars had to know somebody at City Hall, right? So nothing has changed with me. I'm doing the same snooping around, the same conniving, looking for the same set of characters. And indeed, the escalators had shut down, but while I was there checking it out, I heard music. And I turned and over my back saw a gentleman playing a violin. And it sounded pretty darn good. I'm not a musician. I hack away on a guitar a little bit. It never works out very well. But it sounded good to me. And as I moved in a little closer, I realized this guy's playing a violin that's missing two strings. So how is he playing a two-string violin that well? What the heck is his story? And more importantly, is he my next column? You're sitting out there tonight thinking that Steve has done this compassionate thing, this good deed. He's reached out to a fellow human being, and from the get-go, his instinct was to help this man. I was there to help myself. I wanted to get another column. It's the nature of the beast. That empty space, it's a hungry monster, and you got to keep feeding it. And I was just looking for a column. I'll be honest with you about that. Some of you are thinking of leaving now. Like, we thought he was a good guy. So I move in closer and realize that the violin is all scratched up. I see that he's standing next to a shopping cart that appears to contain all of his belongings. And there he is just playing away. And I notice that he doesn't have a hat out and the violin case is not open. So he's not playing for money. At least it doesn't appear so. So, okay, what guy stands out here on a busy sidewalk in the middle of the day and is playing as if it's a practice session rather than trying to make a few bucks? And I waited for a break and walked up to him, introduced myself, and he jumps back. And he was clearly terrified of me, and there clearly were some mental health issues. I didn't know what. I had no idea. When he calmed down enough, I asked him why he played in that particular spot. And he said, "I play here because of Beethoven." And he points to a Beethoven statue that stands tall in the middle of downtown Los Angeles' Pershing Square. And I, having lived there at that point 4 or 5 years, had never noticed it. And I look, and there's Beethoven. He really is there. The story, if you're wondering, is that the concert hall used to be on that square. And they put Beethoven outside and later moved the concert hall up to what's now called Disney Hall. Beethoven did not make the move. So I said, "Well, maybe I'd like to write about you." And he said, "Oh, why would you want to write about me?" And I said, "Well, that sounds pretty good. I'm just curious about your story." And he said, "Oh, all I'm trying to do is get back on track. I got to get back in the groove, and it's going to take a while." And I could tell that he wasn't going to warm up to me enough that I would get my column that day. But I went back to the office, and I wrote Violin Man on a yellow legal pad where I kept all my column ideas, hoping that one of them would work out. You're always juggling those things. And it's not quite in L.A. like Philadelphia, where if I'm hard up for a column, I would just wander the four blocks to City Hall and walk through the building. Anybody who could not find something should get out of journalism. If you're in City Hall more than 10 minutes, you can't find a story or a column, you know, you should be selling shoes. So I went back to look for Nathaniel and couldn't find him, and I got worried about him, and he had told me he lived on Skid Row. And I went looking on Skid Row and thought, my goodness, this is a horrifying place, Skid Row. There are thousands of people living on the streets of Skid Row in downtown Los Angeles. Part of the problem is the weather. If you're going to be on the streets, L.A. is not a bad place to be. Part of the problem is the obscene real estate. Part of the problem is a sort of two-tiered economy, where it's either you hire the help or you're the hired help. We lost our industrial base, aerospace. It was replaced by a service industry. The absence of living wage jobs puts a lot of people right on the margins. And you catch a bad break. You miss a payment. You're never too far from being out there looking for a sandwich. So I couldn't find Nathaniel. And next time I looked, I saw him. And then on subsequent visits, I saw that he had moved to another location. And each time I got out of the car and talked to Nathaniel, he told me a little bit more of his story. And I found it very compelling. He had grown up in Cleveland. He got interested in music because back then, you're not going to believe this, but the public schools invested in the arts and thought that music instruction was an important part of a well-rounded education. Can anybody here believe that? So, shocking. It's shocking, isn't it? So he, you know, played band instruments, and his mother ran Flo's Beauty Salon at 95th and St. Clair in Cleveland. And Nathaniel would get off from school and go over there and sit and listen to the music that his mother had on the radio. And she said, "Why don't you take piano lessons?" And he seemed to have a knack for it. And Nathaniel was so versatile that in his junior high band, they stuck him with different instruments. He ended up with the string bass because nobody else was strong enough and quick enough to handle that. And he got so good so quickly that his teacher said, you know what, I can't teach you anything, but I have a friend from the Cleveland Orchestra, and he teaches over at the Cleveland Music School Settlement. Why don't you go over and see Harry Barnoff? So Nathaniel would walk a couple of miles to go and take lessons at the Cleveland Music School Settlement, which is a place that was founded on the idea that every child in Cleveland should have access to music, regardless of ability to pay. It was a nonprofit, and they brought in all takers, and Nathaniel couldn't pay, so he went and he got his lessons there. And he found out, and Mr. Barnoff found out, that he was an amazing talent. And he did so well that Mr. Barnoff began encouraging him to think about a career in music. Now, the issue was that Cleveland was on fire. We're back in the civil rights movement, Vietnam War protests, police shootouts, rioting. And here's Nathaniel walking through all of that, going to study music with Harry Barnoff. And this is the story that's coming out to me as I meet with Nathaniel on one visit after another. And one day I go to see him, and he's scratching names on the sidewalk. And I said, okay, who's Betty and Tom and Elizabeth and Robert? And Nathaniel says, Mr. Lopez, very formal and very polite. His mother raised him well. He's 3 years older than I am, but he calls me Mr. So I began calling him Mr. People find this really odd when they see us in public. Mr. Ayers, what do you think about that? I don't know, Mr. Lopez. What do you think? So I said, who are those folks? Whose names are you writing? And he said, those were my students at Juilliard. I said, Nathaniel, you went to the Juilliard School for the Performing Arts in New York City? He said, yeah. I said, well, that's a big deal. And he said, well, I kind of bombed out of there. It didn't work out. I'm just trying to get back on track. Ran back to my office, called Juilliard, said, did you ever hear of a student by the name of Nathaniel Anthony Ayers? He would have been there in the late 60s, early 70s. They checked and they said, sorry, no Nathaniel Anthony Ayers ever came to Juilliard. So I sat down, looked at that yellow legal pad. So do I cross out Violin Man? He's got some mental issues that I can't begin to diagnose or address. How do I even write a column about a guy who thinks he went to Juilliard when he didn't? It's pretty sad. The next day, Juilliard calls back. They made a mistake. Yes, Nathaniel Anthony Ayers had gone to Juilliard. I write my column. First, I ran out and told Nathaniel, you did go to Juilliard. Yes, Mr. Lopez, I'm aware of that. These early conversations were amazing. There were times when he was coherent, when he was lucid, poetic, soulful. He would say the most amazing things. There were other times when he kind of lost the string. I felt like I lost him. I didn't know where he was going. I wrote that first column, and the reaction was pretty much unlike anything, the reaction to anything I've ever written, with the possible exception of a Vince Fumo column or two, maybe a Franny Rafferty column. I did once say, as somebody was talking about how smart John Street was, I said, well, you know what? Yes, he's smart, but consider the company. And at the time, in council chambers, he sat next to Franny Rafferty. So you got John Street, Franny Rafferty. And I wrote in a column that this gentleman edited and approved, so take it out on him, that if you put a bag of groceries in the seat next to John Street, the bag of groceries could get into Harvard. I had to apologize to any supporters of Franny Rafferty, grocery stores first, the Vince Fumo family. Earlier I was talking about Marge Tartaglione and Joan Krajewski, the Boom Boom Sisters. who, in case you're not aware, were the ones who came up with the idea for one book, one city. They went out to lunch one day. They were talking. Have you read anything lately? No, I thought about reading a book, but I never read more than one a year. Joan says, me too. We're here tonight because of Marge and Joan. How about a round of applause? They said, let's take it citywide. Come on. My apologies again to all of the family members. So where was I with the Nathaniel story? Philadelphia is just too fun to come back to. You know? I mean, the same tired jokes are still working 10 years later. Where was I with Nathaniel? Where am I? Okay. So here's the reaction. Here's the reaction. Unbelievable reaction. And readers saw something in that first column that I didn't even see. I was just thinking, okay, I got my column. This turns out to be true. I've got my column. That's what I was thinking. And I didn't even know as I wrote it that what I was writing was a story about second chances. A story that was a there but for the grace of God story. People were rooting for him, and they were rooting for me to find ways to help him. I didn't even think of the term second chance until I was talking to a dear friend from Philadelphia, Buzz Bissinger, when I was thinking about turning this into a book. And I said, I don't know. I mean, it's kind of a dark story in some ways. He said, no, it's not. This is a story about second chances, human connections and second chances. And that's what people will connect with, and that's why it's a book. So what they sent my way, I'm at the LA Times, I'm at my desk, and these boxes start arriving. And I'm looking at them, and okay, what's this? One was a chainsaw box. Okay, who's sending? That's really nice, but why is somebody sending me a chainsaw? And when I opened the boxes, I found violins. And I opened envelopes and found the missing strings. And found sheet music and money to buy the two missing strings. And people wrote the most amazing things. They said, I always thought I'd get back to music. I've had this violin stored, you know, in the basement. I still do want to play again, but Nathaniel needs this more than I do. Please give it to him. I was overwhelmed. I took a couple of the instruments out to Nathaniel, and he still was trying to figure me out. So now here's this guy who is coming out of this building that says LA Times. And Nathaniel told me he relocated to his new spot because there he could see the LA Times. And he knew that I was in there. And he said, you know, I've been a lot of places, New York, Cleveland, Los Angeles, and when I stand in this spot and I can look up there, I know that I'm in Los Angeles and that you're in there. So I bring him these instruments, and he's got his hands on them, and I, you know, just can't believe it. And I said, well, they're yours. And he said, they're mine. What are you talking about? And I said, readers want you to have them. And he said, well, I can't take them. Why not? He said, because I can't cover that. So what do you mean? He said, I don't have the money to pay for them. I don't take things that I don't work for or pay for. I can't do it. And I said, well, here's the deal. These are, in a way, your brothers and sisters. These are fellow musicians who want you back in with them. You don't have to pay them. You playing these instruments and enjoying them is your payment to them. He said, do you think so? And I said, yeah. I said, the deal is you can't have them out here because you're going to get beaten to death for them on the streets. So let me take them back to the Times. And as I began to gather them up, he said, well, Mr. Lopez, didn't you just say they were my instruments sent to me by my brothers and sisters? And I realized that I had a problem on my hands. What am I going to do? I mean, here's this guy, and I might as well have just painted a big bullseye on his back, mug this guy now, get three violins and a couple of cellos. And, you know, those streets can be pretty mean. So I talked to somebody in the office about what I should do, and they said, well, you should call LAMP Community. And what is LAMP Community? LAMP Community in L.A. is Project Home in Philadelphia. And you all know about Project Home in Philadelphia. And I'm not saying that they work exactly the same way or do exactly the same things, but the mission is the same. The mission is to try to bring people in, to give them their dignity and their lives back, to give them a place to live and a purpose, to incorporate them into a community, and to you know, there's this sin that we've committed that we think it's okay in this society to have some of the most vulnerable people among us out there on the streets, and they've got a mental illness. Well, what are we going to do about it? I guess it's okay. Let's leave them out there. Here's somebody on a steam grate. Here's somebody over at 13th and Cherry. What are we going to do about it? We can't do anything. Let's just leave it at that. I mean, would we do that if it was pancreatic cancer? Would we do that if it was some physical ailment? But something about mental illness, something about the stigma, something about the unforgivable lack of general knowledge and public education. And we forget. We look at somebody out there and think, you know, that person, they really screwed up, or they made a choice, or they probably don't want to come in. And I, like many of you, what can you do? You walk past them. You don't want to deal with that dilemma. You give somebody a dollar, well, are they going to buy some wine or some crack? You don't give them a dollar, well, I'm getting into a $30,000 car and driving home to Narberth now and going to spend the night in my cozy house, so now I can feel guilty about that. So what do I do? Well, I don't know what to do, so I do nothing. That's where it is. And I'll get to more on that in a minute, but let's get back to the drama here. Let's get back to Nathaniel. So LAMP says we'll send somebody over and have a look, and they come over and take a look, and there he is playing the violin and the cello, and I said, okay, so what has he got? They said, what do you mean, what has he got? And I said, what is it? Is it, you know, can you diagnose him? And they said, why diagnose him? I mean, he's got some issues, but what's the point of a diagnosis? And I said, well, if you're going to fix him and help him, don't you need to diagnose it? I said, it's a little more complicated than that. I said, well, can you help him? And they said, oh, it's going to take a while. But, yeah, we think we can probably help him. It's going to take some time. So, well, how much time? Oh, you never know. They do it in their own time. It could be days, weeks, could be months, it could be years. And I said, I got to write a column on this thing. What are you talking about? It's going to be years. I got readers emailing me by the hundreds. How's Nathaniel? Did you find a place for him to live? Is he on his meds? That's what everybody wants to know. Is he off the streets? Is he taking his meds? And now it's going to take a while. All right, what do we do? Well, you've started the way you should start. You do this intervention. You meet them where they are. He needs to know that he has somebody he can trust. He needs to have a friend. You're his friend, and it's an important first step. And just be his friend. I said, okay. How long am I going to be his friend? Come on, you're a columnist. You write one and you move on to the next before anybody realizes. You had no idea what you were talking about on the last one. That is the trick, folks. Keep them guessing, keep moving, hit and run. So, I came up with a scheme to tell Nathaniel that we're taking all of those instruments over to LAMP. And they were his, of course, but when he wanted to play them, he had to go over there to play them, because that way I wouldn't worry about him getting hurt. And he says, I'm not going over there. I'm not walking through the middle of Skid Row to get to that stuff. And I said, well, you got to, and I've got to do this, and that's the way it's going to be. And I took the instruments, and I went over there and left them at LAMP. And Nathaniel was supposed to follow me over, and he didn't come. And he didn't come the next day or the next or the next or the next or the next. And I was giving up hope, and readers were wondering, hey, how's Nathaniel? And one day I get a call from LAMP saying, guess who's giving a concert in the courtyard at LAMP? I ran over there, and there's Nathaniel. And this is a place that treats chronic mental illness. Many of the people are in there after decades on the streets, and they offer a home. But it takes a while for somebody to socialize and get comfortable with it. And I watched Nathaniel, and he had an audience, and there were people calling out requests. There's a woman asking if she could hear Beethoven's Fifth. And Nathaniel was happy to oblige. And I thought, okay, this is going to work out great. Look at this. All right, let's get that follow-up column done, move on to something else. Let's go find a crooked politician. And not that I planned this segue, but where is Nutter tonight? You know, we're here at a library event. He's been doing a great job, right? But when I was here in the fall, we were talking about, you know, the tough budget decisions, and they're all tough. But what kind of a country bails out the banks and squeezes the libraries? I don't want to put all of that on Michael Nutter. These are tough things to figure out, and it's not his fault, and I guess he's trying to do his best. But libraries are, you know, they're great equalizers. What is the way to get ahead in this society? Traditionally it was, you know, you had access to good schools in public education. You had living wage jobs, sometimes provided by unions. You had the libraries where you could visit the world and find your ambition. And those are still the ways to a better life. And those are the last things that ought to get squeezed when we have these problems. But I won't say more because I think Nutter has been a really good mayor, and I don't know enough about the specifics to tell you whether he's done right or wrong. It is, however, October or November, he said, no, we'll take care of the libraries. Things have gotten really bad. So let me get back to Nathaniel before I get into trouble. Always skirting trouble, disaster. So where are we in our story? That's right. This was just a test and see if you were paying attention. So I had a wonderful day with Lamp. I went back to my office, and I got a call from somebody at Lamp saying, guess what? Right after you left, Nathaniel tried to leave with the instruments. We caught him at the door and brought him back in. And I said, whew, thank God for that. The next time Nathaniel went, played, gave another nice concert, and this time completed the heist, got away with the instruments. Now he's out on Skid Row. And I'm thinking, great. This is the dumbest thing I've ever done in 30 years as a columnist. Skid Row in Los Angeles has, I'm not exaggerating, thousands of people out there. The jail nearby often dumps people just out of jail onto Skid Row, and many of them are happy to go there because it's an open-air drug market. You've got drug dealers in the middle of the streets. You've got drug dealers counting cash in the middle of the streets. You have prostitutes living in and working out of porta-potties. You have people stark raving mad, some of them walking down the street naked. You have streets where maybe 200 people are in an encampment. You have one side of the street, crack pipes are lighting. The other side of the street, people are injecting heroin into their arms. This is one block from the police station. It's three blocks from Los Angeles City Hall. You'll see amputees, veterans, who have fallen out of wheelchairs, are in the middle of the street, laid out. You don't know if they're dead or alive. You'll see a colostomy bag hanging off of a spinning wheel on the wheelchair. That's Los Angeles. And that's where Nathaniel was. And that's where he was on the streets, on the loose, with a cello and a couple of violins. And the smart columnist is hoping that he doesn't get killed. And I would go and talk to him and say, you got to come in, and you got to come in. And he would say, no, Mr. Lopez, I don't want to come in. And so many of us think that when somebody resists, it's because they don't want to come in, so the hell with them. It is much more complicated than that. There are so many issues. There are so many things. In some cases, it's a symptom of the illness or, you know, the suspicion about how it's going to be if somebody does move in. Can they trust the people that they're coming in to live with. So it's very difficult to make that happen. And I got so worried about Nathaniel that I decided to spend a night with him on Skid Row to see what he was up against. So we met up in his usual spot, and here's how the night began. Nathaniel pulls the cart in, and he parks it, and he begins crushing the cockroaches on the sidewalk, kicks them into the gutter. He's picking up cigarette butts. He's a neat freak. He's clearing all of the rubbish from the street. And I'm looking up into lighted windows where you can see people. I say, Nathaniel, wouldn't it be great to be in there? I mean, all you want to do is play music and get better at it. Wouldn't it be great if you had a place like that? You could park these instruments. You could take one at a time, go out to the park, go sit next to Beethoven, but have the other ones back here in a safe place. You can use the bathroom. You could sleep on a bed. Oh, no, Mr. Lopez. Don't care to do that. But he said, you know, it is interesting to look up there and think that Beethoven and Mozart used to work through the night in rooms like that. They created something that lasted for centuries. Isn't that an inspiration? Do you think about writers the way I think about musicians, Mr. Lopez? He says the Lord's Prayer, and he walks to the edge of the sidewalk, and he looks out on this scene that I've described, and in a perfect Shakespearean accent, Nathaniel recited the Hamlet soliloquy. He goes back, begins to lay down his bedding. He offers me a blanket and a cushion. He says, I hope you rest well, Mr. Lopez. I hope the whole world rests well tonight. And he takes a hubcap out of the shopping cart. That's his shield. He takes two sticks out of the shopping cart. On one he's written Beethoven, and on the other he's written Brahms. And I said, what do you do with those? And he said, when the rats come out of the sewers, I tap the sticks. I scare them away with Beethoven and Brahms. Good night. He goes to sleep. I wander around Skid Row. And I couldn't remember a story that had moved me so much. And I felt helpless. I felt ashamed. I felt like we had let him down. I felt like we had let down thousands of Nathaniels. And, you know, it didn't happen by accident. We created this. We created the Skid Rows of Los Angeles and Philadelphia. We shut down mental hospitals and never followed through on the promise of the community clinics that would have helped people manage their lives, be treated with dignity, and to take the pressure off loved ones who weren't equipped to handle the challenge. And we were okay with them camping out on streets, and then we'd complain about the bums among us. And now that I knew one of those bums and what kind of a person he was, and I knew something of his soul and his mind, I became determined to do more than just move on to the next column. That was the night that changed everything. Nathaniel was no longer a column. He was a friend. He was an inspiration. And as I thought about how, in a way, lucky he was, I began to envy that he had this passion, that through all of this, the music never left him. Got to get back in the groove, Mr. Lopez. Got to get back on track. The music has sustained him through 30-plus years of struggles. And believe me, the struggles are incredible. Every single day, Nathaniel has to try to distinguish between the real and the imagined. And it's never easy. And, well, is he on his meds? No, he's not. Because when he was on his meds, it was Thorazine. And Thorazine turned him into a zombie. He couldn't play his music. He was in handcuffs. He was in shock therapy. And he's not going back there. And he doesn't want to hear about the new generation of antipsychotic meds. And he believes that he's got the answers. And there were days when I felt that Nathaniel did have the answers. I would drive home from work, wrung out, stressed out about another crazy day in a dying industry, wondering about how long I could keep my allegiance to it. I'd go through the tunnel, hoping to get home in time to, you know, do battle with the telephone company or whatever other problem was on my desk, say hello and good night to my daughter, and I would pass Nathaniel, and he'd be sitting on a milk crate playing the cello in the 2nd Street Tunnel in downtown Los Angeles with his eyes closed and his head thrown back in ecstasy. And that passion was there every day. Every day that he got up, he was going to find a way to do something that he loved. And I began to so admire and be inspired by Nathaniel's muse. What an amazing man. How many of us in this life ever find something we're as passionate about or as loyal to? I found this guy, Nathaniel Anthony Ayers, who was in many ways better off than most of us. And I realized that when he took those music sheets in his hand, the world stopped spinning. The notes hadn't moved in 200 years. They were right where Beethoven and Mozart left them. And when he looked at that, and when he disappeared into the music, he was anchored, he was safe, he was home, and he was sane. I'm driving home. There he is again. What's he playing now? Roll down the window. Nathaniel, what is that? Mr. Lopez, it's the Elgar Cello Concerto. I'm having an amazing breakthrough on this piece. Very complicated. I'm breaking through. Mr. Lopez, a guy just pulled up, walked over to me, and set a brand new cello down in front of me. Here it is. What do you think of it? Mr. Lopez, you know, this violin, I'm having some amazing breakthroughs on this. When will you be back? Can I see you tomorrow? It was no longer Nathaniel backing up. It was me backing up. I got to go to work. He'd follow me down the street, around the corner, back to the office. So when that column ran about my night on Skid Row, we got a call from Disney Hall. Would you like to come to a concert? Please bring Nathaniel to a concert at Disney Hall. We've got a Beethoven performance coming up. They're doing the 3rd. I said, Nathaniel, they're doing Beethoven's 3rd. He says, oh, the Eroica. And I said, well, I wouldn't know. He's been my tutor for 4 years. Now I know a little bit. I was a jazz guy before, you know. I mean, when I got to Philadelphia and Mr. Seplo here used to take me to jazz clubs, I became a jazz nut. I know a little bit about jazz. I knew nothing about classical. My tutor is a guy living out of a shopping cart. So he said, I can't go to Disney Hall. And I said, why not? And he said, because people should not have to pay good money to see great music and have to sit next to a guy like me who doesn't have the right clothes and doesn't always take a shower. And I called Disney Hall back and asked Adam Crane, the publicist, would it be okay if we came to a rehearsal instead? And he said, you'd rather come to a rehearsal than a performance, a concert? And I said, yes, and we went. And when we got up there, the closer we got, the mellower Nathaniel was. The medicine was kicking in. 2 blocks away, I said, you know, I'm coming here next month to see Itzhak Perlman with the National Symphony. You've gotten me so interested in classical. I'm at Tower Records. I'm, you know, pausing over, do I get the Jacqueline Dupre Bach unaccompanied cello suites or the Yo-Yo Ma Bach unaccompanied cello suites? I end up buying both, take them home, and tell my wife their interpretation is slightly different. I'll have to talk to my homeless friend to explain this stuff to me. That's who's out there, folks. It's you and it's me. It's musicians, it's professors, it's plumbers, it's us, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters. That's who's out there right now. They're us. So we go to Disney Hall, and we get in, and he's the VIP, and they give us an escort, and we meet Esa-Pekka Salonen, the conductor. And we go into the hall, and one of the cellists bounces off the stage, can't wait to meet Nathaniel. And he says, Nathaniel, you are such an inspiration. You're a hero. I'm so proud of you. And he says, you're the one in the orchestra. Why do you find me an inspiration? He said, because of what music has done for you, because of the way you relate to music. It's pure. It's honest. You know, we work for a living. Music is our job, and we love it, but the music for you is just much purer. It's more honest, and you're just an amazing man to find a way to have the music get you through all of this. We sit down, we watch the performance. Nathaniel is whispering to me what the Eroica is all about, why it's even named the Eroica, what that means. And when it's done, he leans forward and says, "Bravo." And then takes out his violin and plays in Disney Hall. The orchestra is cleared. Nathaniel is alone in Disney Hall playing the violin. Lamp was saying, "You know what? We think he's coming around. We think he's coming around. We're holding a room for him." I went to that cellist who bounced off the stage and I said, "Mr. Peter Snyder, would you be willing to give Nathaniel lessons in an apartment on Skid Row? Because I think it might be the thing that gets him in." And he said, "Yes, I'd be happy to." Those were some of the most wonderful days of my career and my life, sitting in that little apartment with Peter Snyder giving Nathaniel lessons on cello. It wasn't always easy. Sometimes it was contentious. But the sound was beautiful, and the idea was beautiful. And Nathaniel said, "But I'm not coming in. I can't leave Beethoven out there alone." Adam Crane, the publicist from the L.A. Phil, went to the Disney Hall store, bought a bust of Beethoven. We put it in the apartment with a photo of Nathaniel's mother. And 1 year after I met him, he moved in. 3 years later, Nathaniel is still in that room. He has a music studio 2 blocks away. The donations keep coming in. He has a piano, a string bass, viola, trumpet, French horn, 6 violins, 2 cellos, the guitar that he wants to play now, and he's lately taken up drums. We go to concerts together, and we go backstage during intermission. Everybody in the LA Philharmonic knows him. One day he was wearing a T-shirt, Nathaniel was, and it said Yo-Yo Ma on it and a concert date. And I said, "What's that?" And he said, "Yo-Yo Ma's coming to town. Can you get us tickets?" I said, "Nathaniel, nobody in L.A. can have an easier time of getting tickets than you." His good friend, Ben Hong, assistant principal cellist in the L.A. Philharmonic, who has now become my friend, along with violinist Robert Gupta and cellist Peter Snyder. I've got buddies in the L.A. Phil because of my relationship with a schizophrenic homeless man who I met living out of his shopping cart. What a wonderful adventure this has been. We go up to Disney Hall. We're escorted to our seats. We see the concert, and we go backstage, and Nathaniel has worn his best clothes. He's got a necktie on. He's worked on his hair for 20 minutes. And we're in that room, and he's so excited because back when he was at Juilliard, one of his classmates was Yo-Yo Ma. Yo-Yo Ma walks to the entrance, looks at Nathaniel, and Nathaniel looks at him, and I found myself asking, "Okay, which of these guys is really the success story?" And you could say Yo-Yo Ma, he's not done badly for himself. But Yo-Yo Ma doesn't wake up every day trying to figure out what's real and what's not. Yo-Yo Ma hasn't lived on Skid Row. Yo-Yo Ma hasn't had uncontrollable neurochemical rages. Yo-Yo Ma walked over to Nathaniel and he said, "Nathaniel, anybody who loves music as much as you do is a friend of mine." He took his hand and he said, "You and I are brothers." And then he wrapped his arms around him and hugged him. And he said, "We're brothers in music." And Yo-Yo Ma stepped back. And Nathaniel didn't know what to say. And Yo-Yo Ma fortunately did. He said, "I've got to go meet some other people. Why don't you take my cello and fiddle with it until I come back?" And Yo-Yo Ma walked out, and Nathaniel stood there and said, "Mr. Lopez, that was Yo-Yo Ma." And I said, "And you are Mr. Nathaniel Anthony Ayers. Thank you for coming. We're going to take some questions now."
What is Nathaniel doing now?
Nathaniel is working on arpeggios on the guitar. I took him some guitar books on Monday morning. He wants a classical guitar now. Says he thinks that's his instrument. He still lives in that same place. He still resists any kind of formal treatment. He still has music as his primary medication. He has wonderful days, and we have great times together. The first time he came to my house, he played the violin, the cello, and the piano. He recited that Hamlet soliloquy. He sang in Italian and spoke in French. My wife thought about leaving me for him. My daughter at the time was 2, and the whole thing was a spectacle. Let's say Nathaniel dresses colorfully. That day he was wearing a police crime scene yellow tape as a bandana and a Hawaiian shirt. And he had just a great time, and it was a joy having him there. He went out on my back deck, and he looked up into the hills, and he saw the Hollywood sign. And he called his sister in Atlanta and said, Jennifer, I think I'm in Hollywood. It's beautiful here. You need to come out and see us. It's still a struggle. He's not out of the woods. This is not a disease that goes away. But it can be managed. And I don't want you to leave tonight thinking that we don't know what to do about this. We do know what to do about it. The tragedy is not we can't figure out what to do. The tragedy is we're not doing enough of it. It's called permanent supportive housing, and I'm not going to make a policy speech, but it's not just, okay, here's a shelter. Why don't you stay there a couple of nights and pull yourself together? No. It's here is your new home. Maybe it's a transitional home, but the idea is to bring you back into a community. The idea is to give you some skills, to give you some dignity, whether you need mental health counseling, whether you need to get hooked up with Social Security, whether you need to get in touch with relatives. You can rebuild your life. And I have seen so many lives rebuilt. It's another of the great gifts that I've had in this relationship with Nathaniel. I know the folks there, and I've seen what they've accomplished. It's truly amazing when you have the political will to do what has worked in New York and worked at 15th and Fairmount and works at LAMP Community. We just don't have nearly enough of it. And at the place where Nathaniel lives, LAMP Community, I asked the director, Casey Horan. I said, hey, Casey, I'm going to speak to a group about this. Tell me again, what is the waiting list for people who have a serious mental illness, go to LAMP for daytime services, but there's not room enough for them to have a bed at night? She said, we're at 700. That's one agency in downtown Los Angeles. So if we know that that works, and here's another point. Is this to save money that we don't have enough of those? Because I could make a pretty good argument that we're not saving money, we're losing money. When you do the churn, when you arrest somebody for jaywalking, which is what happens on Skid Row, it doesn't matter if you're obviously dealing with a serious mental illness. You'll get stopped, you might get handcuffed, and there might be a warrant out because you didn't have the means to figure out how to get to court the last time, and even if you did, you didn't have the fine. So now there's a warrant out. So now you're going to the courts, you're maybe going to state prison, maybe they'll take you to psychiatric emergency, and all of that costs a fortune. It's easier to get to it before all of that goes wrong, to pick the people who obviously need help and to give them the kind of help that we know works. So that's the environment that Nathaniel's in. And my great hope is that although we have horrible days, and sometimes he yells at me and other people, and you can even see that change in him, he's showing progress. He's more social. He's more involved in activities there. And my hope is that he can reach his two dreams, which are, number one, play in a community orchestra, and number two, become a music therapist. At the Cleveland Music School Settlement, they have a program there where they teach teachers to use music as therapy. And Nathaniel would be great at it. He has even had the patience to get through trying to give me violin and cello lessons. And I think that he'd be a great teacher. So that's my hope, is that he might get there, but it could take, like they told me in the beginning, recovery is not linear. Just because you took two steps forward, one on Wednesday and one on Thursday, does not mean Friday will be better. It might be worse. But be patient and be his friend. It's the most important thing you can do for Nathaniel. So that's what I'm continuing to try to do.
The movie, and who wrote this?
He asks, what is the release date of the movie, and who wrote the screenplay? The movie I've seen, and it's very good, but do not make the mistake. Whether you're sitting upstairs tonight or downstairs, do not make the mistake of seeing the movie without first having read the book. I'm not saying the book is better than the movie. I'm just pitching the book. I mean, it's April 24th. It's April 24th, and the screenwriter was Susanna Grant, who wrote In Her Shoes, a Philadelphia-based story, and wrote Aaron Brockovich. And when DreamWorks asked her if she was available, she was available and wanted to do it. And the thing has been sort of blessed from the beginning. They got the director they wanted, Joe Wright, who did Atonement and Pride and Prejudice. They got the actors they wanted. Jamie Foxx plays Nathaniel. Robert Downey Jr. plays me, even though it's obvious to everybody who has seen us that he is, first of all, a little bit too old, and second of all, way too short to play me. It's been fun to see that whole experience, to go to the movie set, to talk to these people, to see what they, how they convert a book into a movie. It's been fascinating, and I can tell you that the movie is really good, and not only good, but honest and true to the book, true to the story. It's April 24th.
What happened between Juilliard, and how did he go from Juilliard to L.A.?
Okay, when he left Juilliard, Nathaniel was back in Cleveland. He stayed for off and on with his mother. But that was difficult. His mother had remarried a couple of times, and Nathaniel didn't always get along with his stepbrothers and sisters, because that's difficult enough on its own, and here he is dealing with this disease. And he'd be out on the streets for a while. And when his mother died around the year 2000, he decided to come to go to L.A. because his father, when his father left the family when Nathaniel was 9 or 10, moved to Los Angeles and was driving a garbage truck for the city of L.A. And Nathaniel thought, Mom's dead. His sister Jennifer is in Atlanta. He's going to L.A. to look for Dad. He gets out there not knowing that his dad had moved to Nevada. And his dad is somebody who doesn't get it. When I asked his dad about Nathaniel and was he proud of his son, he said, my son is out on the street because he prefers that lifestyle. And I said, no, it's not quite the way it works, but he's of a different generation and maybe a little too late to educate on that subject. So Nathaniel was in L.A. for a couple of years, as far as I can determine, before that day that I met him on the street. Yeah.
Hi. I have a question about 3rd and Indiana. We actually teach that at my high school. And also the soloist, as a matter of fact. We're starting to do that this year. And I was wondering how real were the characters also in 3rd and Indiana, Gabriel and his mother?
The characters in 3rd and Indiana were inspired by real people. I got to tell you, I had no idea what the heck I was doing when I wrote that book. And I wrote it a little bit out of anger. Maybe since we're at a public library, I should tell you this. I'll tell you how I came to write that book. I grew up in a middle-class house with parents who had not been to college, who did not read and did not encourage us to read, and there were no books in the house. There was nothing. And I went to a pretty lousy Northern California public school system where you could skate by without doing much work, and I think I got through high school and most of college without reading any books. I had perfected, however, the art of reading the flaps and pulling a couple of passages from the inside part of the book, which I would occasionally look at, and do my book reports, and I had, you know, enough writing skills, probably because I inherited them from my mother, who's one of those people of a generation that's untapped talent. She was a homemaker, and I knew when she would write me letters that she was probably the writer in the family. And if I have any skills, they're from her. But it was when I moved to Philadelphia that I woke up. And I thought, okay, I've missed the whole world. What a dope I am. I'd hear conversations at the Philadelphia Inquirer, people who had had these great weekend activities or, you know, read these great books, and they're talking about the museums they visited. And I went to, you know, maybe my 40th Phillies game of the year and learned nothing at all, except that they were definitely not going to win that year either. So when I woke up and I thought, I guess reading can help you become a better writer, I consciously made a list of all of the books that I could remember blowing off. And I started reading them. I went to the store and bought stacks of books. Why, did you do the same thing? Or you're sitting there chuckling, what a dope this guy. He's been chosen for the one book. One Philadelphia. He's never read a book. What a disaster. Is Dave Eggers out there? Please, Dave, come back. So when I made up this, list of the books that I should read, I started going through them, and they were, you know, The Catcher in the Rye. And when I got to To Kill a Mockingbird, I said, oh my God, the light went on. I thought that was the most fabulous thing I'd ever read. Other than maybe a Pete Dexter column. And I said, not only am I reading all of these books, I'm writing my own goddamn books just to get even with the world. With my parents for not making me read, with the shitty public school system I went to that allowed people to skate through, and I was mad at everybody until I realized that I was the dope, and I could have read if I wanted to, and I didn't. And I have a lot of catching up to do. My son, the philosopher and library science major, knows things about the world that I don't have time to catch up on. I mean, he's a voracious reader, and he, I'm inspired by his passion for the written word and for ideas. So I'm reading To Kill a Mockingbird, saying I'm writing my own damn book. And Third in Indiana, the book grew out of a column. And I swear to you, I went to the library or to the bookstore and bought books on how to write fiction. And as I was writing Third in Indiana, they were on the desk there next to the computer. And I was flipping through, trying to figure out how to write. I mean, I could put a couple sentences together, but the construction of a book, I had no idea. So that's where it came from. It's all the more reason that it's such a privilege for me to appear at events like this, to talk. I still feel like I'm going to be found out. I have no business writing books or talking about them or talking about the writing process. I'm just not qualified. But that is the absolute truth about how I came to write Third in Indiana. And the book business is a crazy thing. Before it was actually published, it was getting some nice buzz. And, another company said, hey, we'll give you a 2-book contract. So now here I am writing the second book. The first one's not published. I still haven't really learned how to write a book. And now you've got these deadlines, and come on, OMG, the sales on the second one are not matching the sales on the first. That third one really better be something. And it didn't ever really work for me. I think I wrote some pretty average books, and then I think felt a little more comfortable with this one because it was more in my natural style and tone, and probably more importantly, for the first time, I really had a story to tell. And that's one of the great tricks of writing well, is to have something to say. And I had Nathaniel. Nathaniel is just a compelling character, and it was much easier to write that book. In fact, with my daughter 2 years old, I didn't want to miss time with her, so I thought, okay, she gets up at 7:30. I'm getting up at 5 every morning. I had a 1-year deadline. If I can write for 2.5 hours every morning, And on Saturdays and Sundays, she was sleeping from 1 to 4 in the afternoon. So I've got 6 hours there, 2.5 to 3 hours every weekday morning. If I can do 2 chapters a month, this will work. And I stuck to that pretty much. And after DreamWorks optioned my book proposal, we were in a situation where I was writing a chapter and sending it to the screenwriter who was writing the screenplay at the same time. And we finished at roughly the same time. And then I couldn't believe that things fell into place. They got this director. They got everybody else they needed. And they said, yeah, we'll start shooting in February in downtown L.A. And I'm thinking, they're not going to start shooting. This thing ain't going to work out. Something's going to fall through. And they started in February, and they were done by April. And it's a darn good movie. It really is a good movie. And I do hope that you'll go and see it after reading the book.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.